Manipalasutta, section on the divine eye. It starts out with the mind thus concentrated, purified, cleansed, without blemish, without defilements, become soft, workable, steady, attain to imperturbability. One bends and inclines the mind to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearing, upapata, of beings, satta. With the divine eye, dibbena chakkhuna, and remember we discussed the use of dibba as a prefix from the ancient Indo-European root. The root form of it is dis or something. I was just looking at it actually. With many words in English, day and divine and deity and all of these from the same root. And I just found another one just this morning. Journey is another one. Actually from the same root. Yeah, D-I often becomes J. So journey is actually the same one, but originally having the meaning of a day's period of time travelling for a day, the journey. Yojana is from similar meaning, yeah, but from a different root. That's from yuj, to bind up the, to yoke the horses or the oxen, whatever. So journey. Was jour in French today. Right. So, the divine eye that is purified, visuddha, and which surpasses the human is manusaka, and atikanta, ati, beyond, kanta, going. Okay. Satte pasati. He sees beings, chavamane, falling away, upapajamane, and re-arising, hine, inferior, pamite, superior, suvarne, beautiful, dubarne, ugly, sugate, in heaven or good destiny, duggate, in the bad destiny. So this is from the root gachati, to go, or root gum, to go, and with the prefix su and dug. Okay, so literally like a destiny, place, a good born. Yatakam upage. He sees beings born, one understands beings arising according to their karma. And very important to know when discussing karma that I think this is the first time we've actually encountered karma, isn't it, in the gradual training? I don't think we've actually met it before. In the gradual training, is there anywhere? I don't think there's any other meaning of karma so far in this particular text. And what karma is said to condition is where you get reborn. So remember that. It's not said to be the condition for everything that happens to you in your life, right? But the condition for actually where you get reborn. It's a very, very important point which most Buddhists don't understand. And so it's something which you find you have to explain again and again and again. So you should be very clear in your minds about this point. Karma is not something which determines every detail of your life. It's something which primarily directs where you're born. Okay? Of course, it influences other things as well. I'm not saying that's only where you're born, but that's the main thing that it does. Ne, vata bondo. Oh dear. Vata means oh dear. Ne, these, oh dear, these good gentlemen, satta, these good creatures, kaya duchari tena, after due to bad contact with the body, okay, so the body kaya. Du, again, bad charita conduct. Sorry? Bad bodily conduct. Endowed with samannagata, so we've been endowed with, bad bodily conduct. Vachi duccharitena, endowed with bad conduct of speech, and endowed with bad conduct of mind. Aryanang upavaraka, who are revilers of the noble ones. Okay, so those noble ones are evil and nasty and so on. Mitcha diatika, who are of bad views, wrong views, who have undertaken karma. Samadana is to undertake, is what the word you use for undertaking precepts. Okay, so samadhiyami, when you say sikkhapadang samadhiyami, it's the same word here. So karma, they have undertaken karma because of their wrong view. Michaditti karma samadana. Then they, with the breaking up of the body, kayasa bheda paramarana, and of course this being one of the standard phrases, kayasa bheda paramarana, which obviously shows that death in Buddhism always means physical death, and the word marana is never used, birth, aging and death is never used in a psychological sense in the Pali texts. Apayang, apaya is the word for hell or the lower realms. I'm just trying to think of the etymology of it. Apaya. What's the etymology of apaya? Can't remember. And eat, okay, getting away from separation, loss of property, leakage, lapse, and so on. So apaya is a word for all of the lower states of rebirth, from upper and e. Okay, separation. Interesting etymology, isn't it?
Separation.
Yeah, that's basically what it means. Being cut off from.
Separation from what it's
like to know the damage and the process.
Is that the same word that's
used? No. No, it's not the same word, but similar idea, yeah. Of course, in English we go to hell, which is the hall, which is etymologically the sala. Yeah. So. Yeah, I believe. Yeah, because it's the halls of the dead. So we go to the sala is going to hell.
What's Hades then?
Hades is.
That's not hell. Doesn't come from Hades.
No, hell is a Germanic word. Hades, I'm not sure. Okay, apayam dukating, bad destiny. Vinipata is the downfall. Pata is to fall, as in pindapata. Ni is down. And vi is an intensive here. If you understand it as an intensive. Nirayam, just a word for hell. Upapanna, one's reborn. Okay, so after doing those bad karmas, then you get reborn in a bad destiny. Ime wa, or these good beings, due to. So this is an instrumental ending. Due to good bodily conduct, kaya su charitena, or endowed with good conduct of body, good conduct of speech, vachi su charitena, and good conduct of mind, mano su charitena, they are not revilers of the noble ones. They don't abuse the noble ones. They have right view. And they practice karma or do deeds which are based on their right view. Their kaya sat beheda, due to the breaking up of the body after death, they arise in a good destiny, in the heavenly world. So the Sagga, in Sanskrit, Svarga. It's the Sanskrit form. Is that in English? I'm not sure if that is an English cognate. Sagga, Sagga, Sagga. Svarga, Svar, oh, Svar and Ga. Maybe from the same root as Sugati, if it's the root of Ga, maybe, to go. So maybe just a different formation from the same root. Huh. Okay. In the heavenly realm, one is reborn, upapanna. So this word upapanna literally is to arise, but typically means to be reborn. Right, exactly, yes. So this isn't samadhiti in the technical Buddhist sense, yeah. And that's a good point. So in this kind of thing, samadhiti usually means basically having some kind of belief in karma or a belief in morality, as opposed to, so for example, like, I mean, generally speaking, like if you're from an eternalist point of view, then you'd have that kind of right view, as opposed to, say, an annihilationist point of view or something, or moral nihilism or something.
So what's the difference between, are you saying that that's different from anything? I mean, when you're just going to list us, yeah, so. The
right whatever
in the Eightfold Path. So, can you explain
to
me what the difference is and why?
Because in the Eightfold Path, it's usually described as understanding the Four Noble Truths. Okay. Whereas right view here is obviously not something which is limited to Buddhism. Four Noble Truths are specifically Buddhist. So here it's just talking about anybody who, you know, lives a good life and does good karma. You wouldn't know, just you can't know from just in that text. Yeah. But the difference between the two is explicitly described in a few places. Most well known is the Mahatattarisaka Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, where it gives the two different kinds of right view. Chattarisaka, I can't remember the two. Anyone remember the number? Yeah, do you remember the Mahatattarisaka Sutta
117.
And okay, so it's a very interesting sutta that is to this particular thing. It starts out, okay, here we go. What is wrong view? There is nothing given, there is nothing offered, there is nothing sacrificed, kutang. There's no fruit and result of good and bad deeds. There is not this world, there is not another world, there is no mother, there is no father, there is no beings who are spontaneously arisen, there is no world. In this world there are no ascetics and Brahmins who are well practiced and well, another word that's a simile for practiced, that having seen this world and realized this world with their own direct knowledge, describe it. This is called wrong view. And what is right view? There are two kinds, I say, monks of right view. There is the right view which is sasava, with defilements or associated with rebirth, probably a better way to put it. Punya bhagya, partaking of merit. Again, this is the idea that that's taking, you know, gets you reborn. Upadhi vepaka, and which ripens. Vepaka is just a form from an adjective from vipaka, and upadhi. Upadhi is a technical term, but it basically means stuff. So, so there's this right view which is associated with defilements, ripening in partaking of merit and ripening in stuff. Right. In other words, if you practice this kind of good, literally, I mean, it's literally what it means is if you practice this kind of right view, you'll end up with stuff. You'll end up with a big house with a nice car and lots of stuff. You know, that's what upadhi vipaka means. There is, because the right view, which is noble, undefiled, transcendental, and a factor of the path. Okay, so what is the first kind of right view, which is with defilements, but associated with or partaking in merit and ripening in stuff? There is what is given, there is what is offered, there is what is sacrificed, there is the fruit and result of good and bad deeds, there is this world, there is the other world, there is mother, there is father, there are beings who are spontaneously reborn. There is in the world ascetics and Brahmins who are well practiced and who, having realized this world with their, having realized it with their own direct knowledge, declare this world and the next. This is called the right view, which is sasava, with defilements, taking of merit and ripening in stuff. What, because, is the right view which is noble, without defilements, transcendental, and a factor of the path? What month is the for one who with a noble mind, arya citta, or a mild mind without defilements, an asava cittasa, arya magga samangino, associated with the noble path, for one developing the noble eightfold path, is wisdom, faculty of wisdom, the power of wisdom, the awakening factor of Dhamma Vijaya, investigation of Dhammas, right view as a factor of the path. This is called the right view, which is noble, and so on and so forth. All right. So usually called mundane right view and supramundane right view, or something like that, or mundane and transcendental right view. So one of them being the kind of ordinary everyday right view that just ordinary good people have, that leads them to do good deeds and live a good life, and then the other one being the right view which specifically leads to awakening. Okay, so just to comment, the technicalities of this particular passage are actually somewhat complex and were taken up and became very, this particular passage became very significant in the Theravadan tradition. There are differences between this passage and the cognate one in Chinese. One of Bhikkhu Bodhi's earlier essays dealt with precisely this passage, so if you're interested you can look that up. And this is why the Theravadan tradition then sort of relegated that to one mind moment. So according to the Theravadan tradition, this is just a mind moment. The transcendental right view is one mind moment. Okay. No problems. So, so see things being born and reappearing according to their karma. And so it repeats that thus with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human. He sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, in a good and bad destiny, and getting born according to their karma. And so then comes the simile. Seyatapi. Just like. Great king. Madhe Singhatake Pasado. There is a palace in the middle of the, I think the Singhatake was the crossroads, if I'm not wrong. In the middle of the crossroads, I think. It's interesting. Okay, there's a man with good eyes was standing, and he would see people going into the houses, coming out of the houses. They would travel in their cars down the road, or in their chariots down the road, and then they would sit down in the middle of the square. So there's people leaving it, walking along the streets, walking up and down the streets. Then he would think, reflect to himself, oh, here are these people going into the houses, coming out, walking down the streets, and sitting in the middle at the crossroads. In just the same way, great king, a bhikkhu with mind concentrated would recollect, or would see beings passing away and being reborn according to their karma. And this also, great king, is a visible fruit of the holy life, which is more sublime and higher than those which have come before. See, the passage itself is not specific on that, so I guess it could be used in both ways.
In the
party.
In the, like, the divine, but the psychic powers, it's very obvious that it's the speaker of whatever, who can, go to the wall or do whatever.
Right.
Here it's...
It seems to be certainly a generalised ability. And one would presume that if you had some skill at it, you'd be able to focus it to find out who is being reborn. That's true, yeah, it's all in the present participle.
And
that's right, yeah.
So, if it's in the present tense, that means there's a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni, okay, sitting there with mind concentrated, etc., would see things as they happen right at this moment, like whatever happens to the dying and doing, here, there, or whatever.
Yep.
They would see if in that moment what was happening there and then, not sort of looking back at what happened weeks ago, or what's going to happen in the future, or anything like that.
Yeah, well, that's literally what it says. So, it's not clear. Again, just strictly from the description, it's not clear whether it could be used in the past and the future, but certainly stated in the present tense. Yeah.
And is this the bhikkhu
that's
knowledge is sort of, I find it interesting, is there. Anyway, what's this? I can see the purpose of God, but I can see this, enables someone to see or have knowledge, direct knowledge of the anicca.
Yeah.
Walking down the street, coming back
from
their lives, arriving and passing away,
and it. Well, it'd be kind of fun.
Probably oxygen established right now.
Pardon?
And probably oxygen established right now.
Well, I would have thought that by the time you got to this stage, you're right here. Should be quite well established.
The Samaritan
would be able to do this, isn't it?
Yeah. Just
that Arian. When you say Arian, do you mean one of these, like, the eight?
Eight persons, yeah.
Eight persons.
Yeah.
Does a partner have all of these?
Again, it depends.
Yeah,
some stream managers will, some won't. Some non-Arians will, some won't.
So it's not necessary that all Arians will have all of the knowledge?
No.
Yeah.
So we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. So just for now, just kind of bear that in mind. But the basic idea is simply that I think we talked about this. Did we talk about it last week or sometime recently? Talked about the notion of how you actually gain wisdom. So you're still accumulating, you're learning information. Yeah, and so you're learning more information about what life is, what samsara is, what rebirth is. And when you recollect your past lives, you saw, well, you know, this is what's happened to me. Yeah, but of course that doesn't tell you what's going to happen to me again in the future. Yeah, it's still not exhausting all the possibilities necessarily. So now you're exhausting a few more options, right? You're looking down the careers page, thinking, is that going to be my future? 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 And then you're seeing what these things actually are, yeah? And so you don't get taken in by them.
Things also show you're not some special kind of being.
Exactly, so you're generalising from, you're further generalising both in time but also, yes, from myself to others.
Yeah, sort of, you know, if I am real, everyone else is sort of, you know, imaginary or something.
Yeah.
Like I'm different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could we say that this way is kind of, you're actually investigating the same origination, but this way of looking is just more pragmatic.
Closely related to dependent origination, but it's not quite the same thing. Dependent origination is more associated with the final knowledge. And the reason is that the essential difference is that the knowledge of karma and rebirth here is ethical. Dependent origination is existential. There's nothing about ethics in dependent origination, whereas here it's talking about, you know, you're with good eye, you see people being reborn in a good place, and with bad acts, you get reborn in a bad place. So that's why it's not actually specifically Buddhist, yeah. And whereas dependent origination is, so it's certainly getting towards that, but there's that significant shift. So for example, that's why, say here we have karma, which is very closely associated with ethics, and then in dependent origination that's replaced with sankhara. And sankhara is a much more neutral term; it's not an ethical term in the same way, yeah, yeah. Dependent origination is existential. It goes deeper down into the roots of things. Rather, this one is more about choices and how to live. Yeah.
Yeah, this point hasn't seen the machinery of striving on this. Just got to see the input and the output. People can be both of them see how we can
inside. Yeah.
Is it fair to say then, from this perspective, that wisdom is comprised of those entanglements?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think that wisdom is limited to these things, but certainly there are important kinds of ways of developing a wisdom. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let's just have a look at what the Visuddhimagga has to say about the divine eye. Blah, blah, blah. It's called divine because it's similarity to devas, who have the sensitivity that is produced by karma consisting in good conduct. and is unimpeded by bile, phlegm, blood, etc., and is capable of receiving an object even though far off because it's liberated from imperfections. In other words, the vision that you get through this is similar to the deva's eyes, so one reason for it being called divine. One who sees only passing away and not reappearance becomes an annihilationist. And one who sees only reappearance and not passing away takes up the view of eternalism, or the view that there is a real being who appears. But seeing one who sees both outstrips that twofold false view. That vision of his is therefore a cause for purification of view. Okay, so this is one of the ideas which is developed partially in the suttas in dependent origination, but more explicitly in the commentaries as we just hear, is that if you just watch the passing away of things, then you end up as an annihilationist. And if you just watch the arising of things, you become an eternalist. Okay? And this is actually developed in the Nidana Sanyutta in the context of dependent origination. And that's actually one of the reasons why the dependent origination has the structure that it does. We'll get into a kind of complicated thing, but dependent origination has this kind of spiral structure where the two ends of it essentially cover the same ground but using different formulation, different vocabulary. And the reason for that different vocabulary is because each of them is countering one of these views, annihilationism or eternalism. So, seeing passing away and reappearing, he cannot see them with the divine eye actually at the death moment or at the moment of reappearance. Interesting. But it is those who, being on the verge of death, will die now that are intended as passing away, and those who have taken rebirth linking and have just reappeared that are intended by reappearing. Curious, isn't it?
Well, how would you know if you were directly your divine eye to these things?
And they just pop
how
out.
Would you know that this one that's passed away is the same one that's reappeared?
Well, I guess.
Not just a spontaneous appearance of something and passing away of something.
Well, yeah, that's.
So, how do you know that this one? I think that in dependent origination, it shows the connection between.
Right.
How do you know that there is a connection, or is there?
So yeah, this is the Theravadan tendency is to Theravada likes very clean categories. It doesn't like leakages across boundaries. So the whole Abhidhamma is designed in order to prevent any murkiness on borders. So it's this kind of fear of boundaries. So you can't have anything actually crossing a boundary. It has to actually disappear in one point and then reappear at another. Yeah, and which of course is completely different from what the simile is saying, which is saying precisely that you watch them wandering up and down the road.
Yeah.
So this is this question.
They go into your house, then they come out.
Right. So this is the question of the intermediate state, which the Theravadan tradition denied, but which all of these similes obviously assume, right? So, you know, that's what it's like. You walk out of the house, wander down the road, and then walk into another house. It's obviously talking about a process of movement from one to the other. And here, this very forced interpretation shows how uncomfortable the Theravadan tradition was with that kind of way of seeing things. Okay. Faring on according to the deeds. Okay, the order in which the knowledge of faring according to deeds is like this. Here, a bhikkhu extends light downwards in the direction of hell, and he sees beings in hell undergoing great suffering. That vision is only the divine eye's function. He gives it attention in this way. After doing what deeds do these beings undergo this suffering? So that's the first stage, is you just use the light of the divine eye to just go, you know, get the vision of hell. And then you reflect, what was the karma that they got the, why they got reborn in this way. Then knowledge that has those deeds as its object arises in him in this way. It was after doing this. So you have this intuitive knowledge of the karma which arises when you reflect. So first of all you see them and then you reflect and the knowledge arises intuitively according to this description. Likewise, he extends light upwards in the direction of the divine world and sees beings in the Nandana grove, in the Misaka grove or the Parusaka grove, etc., enjoying great fortune. And then you reflect on what is what karma was that they enjoyed this good deed. Now, according to the explanation here, there is no special preliminary work for this. Okay, so there's no particular training. You know, we've seen like in recollecting most of the psychic powers, and certainly the past lives, is that there's a special parikama, preliminary work. You gradually recollect further and further back in your life to be able to remember. Whereas here it's saying that there's no special preliminary work, which is kind of curious, I think. But anyway. And as in this case, so too in the case of the knowledge of the future, okay, which is a... So we'll come back to that again. Okay. Okay, so it's describing the reviling of the noble ones, and it gives a story. Here, an elder and a young bhikkhu, it seems, wandered for alms in a certain village. At the first house, they got only a spoonful of hot gruel. The elder's stomach was paining him with wind. He thought, "This gruel is good for me. I should drink it before it gets cold." People brought a wooden stool to the doorstep. He sat down and drank it. The other was disgusted. "This old man has let his hunger get the better of him and has done what he should be ashamed to do." The elder wandered for alms, and on return to the monastery, he asked the young bhikkhu, "Have you any footing in this dispensation, friend?" "Yes, venerable sir," said the young monk. "I am a stream enterer." "Then, friend, do not try for the higher paths. You have reviled one who has destroyed his defilements. You have reviled an arahant." The young bhikkhu asked for the elder's forgiveness and was thereby restored to his former state. So, kind of curious little story there, because he's already a stream enterer. He can't have wrong view. So, anyway, you get the idea. So one who does revile a noble one, even if he is one himself, should go to him. If he himself is a senior, he should sit down in a squatting position and ask for forgiveness, saying, "I have said such and such to the venerable one, may he forgive me," and so on. So this is the asking forgiveness. If the other one has gone away, he should ask forgiveness either by going to him himself or by sending somebody, such as a student. If he could neither go nor send anybody, then he should go to the bhikkhus who lived in that monastery and ask for forgiveness. If he can't find the monk himself, he goes, you know, to other bhikkhus and confesses it to them. If it's a bhikkhu who wanders alone and you can't find out where he lives or where he has gone, he should go to a wise bhikkhu and say, "Venerable sir, I've said such and such to the venerable one named so and so. When I remember it, I'm remorseful. What should I do?" He should be told, "Don't think about it. The elder forgives you. Set your mind at rest." Then he should extend his hands palm together in the direction taken by the noble one and say, "Forgive me." If the one who he has abused has attained final nibbana, he should go to the place where the bed is on which he attained the final nibbana and should go as far as the charnel ground to ask forgiveness. When this has been done, there is no obstruction either to heaven or the path. He becomes as he was before. Okay. So now we're finishing the word commentary. It says, "Now a clansman now goes back and then talks about the actual development of the divine eye. Now a clansman who is a beginner and wants to see in this way should make sure that the jhana, which has a kasina as its object and is the basis for direct knowledge, is made in all ways susceptible of his guidance. Then one of these three kasinas, that is the fire, white or light kasina, should be brought to the upachara, the access of the rising of divine eye knowledge. He should make this access jhana his resort and stop there to extend the kasina. In other words, he should develop the nimitta to a point just short of jhana. He's already developed the jhanas beforehand, but when he wants to do the divine eye, he does this based on the upachara or access samadhi. And he says that the light kasina is the best one to use. And then he should extend the kasina, and what is visible is only that which comes within the area to which the kasina has been extended. However, while he's seeing what is visible, the period of the preliminary work runs out, therefore the light disappears. When that's disappeared, he no longer sees it. He should again and again reattain the basic jhana, emerge and pervade with light, until the light gradually gets consolidated, till at length it remains in whatever sized area it has been delimited by him. In this way, let there be light there. And even if he sits watching all day, he can still see visible objects. Here's the simile of a man who set out on a journey by night with a grass torch. Someone set out on a journey with a grass torch. His torch stopped flaming. Then the even and uneven places were no more evident to him. He stubbed the torch on the ground and it again blazed up. In doing so, it gave more light than before. As it went on dying out and flaring up again, eventually the sun rose. When the sun had risen, he thought, there's no further need of the torch. He threw it away and went on by daylight. Herein, the kasina light at the time of the preliminary work is like the light of the torch. He's no more seeing what is visible when the light has disappeared owing to the turn of the preliminary work running out. When he was seeing what is visible, is like the man not seeing the even and uneven places owing to the torches stopping flaming. His repeating attainment is like the stubbing of the torch. His more powerful pervasion with light by repeating the preliminary work is like the torches giving more light than before. The strong light remaining in as large an area as he delimits it is like the sun's rising. His seeing even during the whole day what is visible in the strong light after throwing the limited light away is like the man's going by day after throwing the torch away. Okay, so in other words, you just keep on practicing, keep on repeating it, and as the samadhi is still not strong, or the divine eye is still not developed strongly, then the one sees falteringly like a flickering torch that keeps going out, but then when it comes to fulfillment, it's like the sun coming up, and you just see things directly. Herein, when visible objects that are not within the focus of the bhikkhu's fleshly eye come into the focus of his knowledge, that is to say, visible objects that are inside the belly, belonging to the heart basis, belonging to what's below the earth's surface, behind walls, mountains and enclosures, or in another world sphere, are as if seen with the fleshly eye, then it should be understood that the divine eye has arisen. Okay, so you actually just see everything. But this is an obstacle for an ordinary man. Why? Because wherever he determines, let there be light, it becomes all light, even after penetrating through earth, sea and mountains. Then fear arises in him when he sees the fearful forms of spirits and ogres, etc., they're growing to which his mind is distracted and he loses his jhana. So he needs to be careful in seeing what is visible. All right? So watch out for that one. All right? Here is the order of attaining. And then it gives the Abhidhamma analysis.
It doesn't refer at all to that in the actual text. Being able to see, you know, through.
Right. Right.
Which is makes the divine eye sort of similar to the divine ear. I mean, the divine ear was like that.
Right. Near and far, yeah.
Very far.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
It's actually got the first eyes to say, like the physical eye. Really.
No, this is also not talking about the physical eye, but it's talking about a vision which you see as if with the physical eye. Yeah. But you're quite right, and it seems that there's a number of different abilities which are actually getting sort of smooshed up together. One of which is, as you say, the ability to simply see far. Another one is the ability to that intuition it talked about earlier, where the intuition of actually knowing where the karma comes from, yeah, seeing relationship to karma, and another one being the knowledge of the future. So these three kinds of knowledge happening here.
Do you think any basic instructions for those intuitions? The Buddha could do it. Feeling might work alone. Ask people what they grasp.
Such as, can you think of an example? No, I think he knew though. I think others will have that ability to see the karma. I don't think that's problematic. But generally speaking, it's understood that this knowledge is future orientated, while the knowledge of past lives obviously is past orientated. But this is saying where beings are headed. What direction are you going? So the understanding side of it is essentially the ability to infer from what's happening now to what's going to happen in the future. You know, not necessarily seeing the future, but having a reasonable inference of it. Yeah? You know, like you see somebody driving down the road to Canberra and you think, oh, well, they're going to Canberra. So it's not necessarily perfect. No, it's spontaneously reborn. Upapatika. It doesn't mean instantaneous. It just means reborn, not in a womb. Yeah. So like a deva or something like that. Yeah. So that's separate from the specific Abhidhamma idea, which is that rebirth always happens instantaneously. Actually, yeah. There's a categorizing of different kinds of ways that you can be reborn. In a womb, in an egg, in moisture. I don't think it has pouches. And then spontaneously reborn is another kind. Yeah. It would be either beings in the ocean or just beings are born in slime or... Yeah, mosquito larvae, yeah. Yeah, in Thai they call them lutnam, it's water baby.
Because we all came from the ocean region.
Yeah. So now it goes on a little bit more to talk about past life. It goes on a bit of a further analysis where it talks about the knowledge of the future, but so unfortunately it gets into a very technical discussion of the different classifications of objects. It's not that interesting. But anyway, so that's probably enough. So so that's the seventh of the eight knowledges, or the fifth of the five abhinya. And so that's the culmination of the whole thing. So, with a mind thus concentrated, purified, cleansed, rid of blemishes, rid of defilements, tender, workable, steady, attained to imperturbability, he bends and inclines his mind to the knowledge of the ending of defilements, of asavas. So the word asava is, of course, translated in many and quite humorous ways, actually. But cankers, found zero entries with asava in the entry. Well, you've got to be kidding. Cankers, defilements, anyone got any other favourite renderings? Intoxicants. poisons, taints, fermentations, influxes, outfluxes, influences. Sorry? No, not fetters, that's another one. That's a sanyojana, yeah, different root. So all of these are kind of quite a variety, anyway, creative variety of terminology. Anyway, let's have a look at what the Pali Dictionary says. Asava, from a prefix, usually meaning in, plus through, meaning to flow. That which flows out or onto, outflow and influx. Okay, so this, first of all, we have this ambiguity here, outflow and influx. It's said that the prefix R can mean both out and in, but I'm kind of skeptical. I mean, presumably there are examples of it, but certainly the normal meaning of R is always coming in. So, you know, to go is gacchati, and to come is agacchati. Yeah, so R very normally has the meaning to come in. So influx to me is much more plausible than outflow. Okay, first meaning is a spirit in the sense of alcohol, not in the sense of ghost or something. The intoxicating extract or secretion of a tree or flower. Four kinds are given, blah, blah, blah. So that's one meaning. So here, hence we have intoxicants, fermentations and the like. Second meaning, discharge from a sore. Okay? So here you have the cankers and so on. Right, so the pus that's leaking out of the sore. In psychology, for certain specified ideas that intoxicate the mind, bemuddle it, befoozle it. Wow, that would be good, befoozlement. That's what I'm going to call afterwards from now on. That is classic. How did we ever miss that? The befoozlements, the knowledge of the ending of all befoozlements. Excellent. So that it cannot rise to higher things. Freedom from the asavas constitutes arahantship, and blah, blah, blah. Okie dokie. So, very common terms. You can see lots of references. Usually, three asavas mentioned is the kama asava, sensual. I'm just going to use the word defilement for asava, actually. Usually they translate kilesa as defilement, but kilesa actually is not found very often in the early suttas, and the normal word that's used in the same sense is asava. So kama asava is sensual defilement, bhava asava is defilement for existence or rebirth, and avijja asava is a defilement for of ignorance. And there has another list of four, which is the same three, but the addition of dittasava, the defilement of views, and that group of four is probably a later development. It's found most characteristically in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya and related texts, found elsewhere but more in later literature, whereas the three, as you can see here, the three is found typically in the Majjhima Samyutta, so probably earlier. Then because asava actually has a somewhat doubtful etymology, but also it is used in natural language in a number of different ways, then it's given all of these different possible translations of fermentations and inflows and outflows and pollutions and corruptions is another one, and so on, all of which are wrong. Okay? They're all wrong and they all miss the point. The actual meaning of asavas shouldn't be understood either particularly by the etymology or by the natural language uses in Pali. It should be understood by reference to the Jaina usage. And for the Jains, the word asava is their standard term. And asava in Jains is a synonym for kama. So in Buddhists, we separate those two out. Your defilements and the karma are separate things. The defilements is the motivation for your karma. But for Jainism, it's the same thing. And the asavas in Jainism, or the karma, is like it's like a quasi semi-material thing, like literally like a pollutant or a toxin, which infiltrates the soul. So in Jainism, you have like an idea of a jiva, which is a pure soul, and which this is infiltrated by these defilements, which smear it and darken it, that's what gives rise to suffering. So it's this idea of like a toxin or a defilement or something which darkens the soul. Now that's how it's always used very very clearly in Jainism. Jainism always has a more it has a more kind of physical idea of these things than Buddhism. In Buddhism, defilements are obviously psychological, whereas in Jainism they're kind of half psychological, half physical. So the usage, as far as I can see, that the usage in Buddhism is clearly based on that usage in Jainism. Yeah? So as with just about all the terminology in Buddhism, it's adopted from, obviously, the language that was around him at the time. And so that was the primary idea that comes with it. So it's the idea of things which are toxic or polluting, which darken the mind.
Is that why they were so intent on mortifying the body?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Exactly.
And physical.
Yeah. And it's exactly in the same way as like purifying a metal. You use the tapas, it's the heat. And you burn it off. You burn off the karma by just burning.
So, are you saying that the Buddha used that word or used that sort of concept, but just applied it in a psychological sense rather than a physical sort of entity?
Exactly.
So it's something that makes the mind impure.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been a common term at the time. It wouldn't have just been a Jain term, but obviously it's very common in the Jaina text. Okay, so asavakaya, so the ending of defilements, and of course the ending of this particular term always is a term for the arahant. Okay, so in fact a synonym for the arahant, very common synonym, is the keen asava, the one whose asavas are ended. And kaya, asavana kaya, is another word which deserves a bit of consideration. So this is not gaya, as in the body. This is kaya. Kaya to the root kshi. Kshinoti, kshinati, compare with the Latin situs, withering, Germanic. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. S-Q-I. I'll leave that to your imagination. Any of our German speakers like to hesitate? Oh, that's probably Greek, isn't it? Greek, not Germanic, yeah. Oh, we don't have any Greek speakers. Anyway, wasting. Kepeti under kipati. Waste, destruction, consumption, decay, ruin, lost. The passing away of the night. Okay? Yeah, so the night, kaya, it comes to an end. Most in applied meaning with reference to the extinction of defilements and so on. But asavana kaya, raga kaya, dosa kaya, moha kaya, tanha, and so on and so forth. Okay, kaya dita, gone beyond the waning period, recovered from the waning period of the moon or the new moon. Okay, and other applied meanings are things like the drying up of a stream, kina sota. Kina is the past participle form. Or the when you use up the supplies, if you're on a journey and you use up your supplies. So this is why I don't like the translation destruction. I've never found any sort of natural language uses of the word kaya where it means destruction, but it always means just when something comes to its own end. Something wears out, withers away, wanes, something like that. It's more gentle than destruction. Yeah, using up the fading away, asavanam kaya, just the ending, the simplest ending of defilements. Okay, so idam dukkhanti yatha bhutang pajanati. So inclines his mind to the knowledge of ending of defilement. So the first stage of that, knowledge of dukkha, knowledge of the origin of dukkha, knowledge of the ending of dukkha, and knowledge of the way of practice leading to the ending of dukkha. Of course, the Four Noble Truths. And the term here, yatha bhutam pajanati, is usually translated as understands as it is or in accordance with. The yatha, yatha means in accordance with. Bhuta is used as a word for the truth, but here it has a more specific meaning, and it means in accordance to conditions, in accordance to how something has come to be. So the translation of things as they really are is not really an accurate translation. It should be the translation of things as they have come to be. If you say that they really are, then that implies an eternalist view.
Could also add that condition.
Yeah? You could translate it as in accordance with conditions.
Well, I mean, it's thinking of conditions.
Yeah. Sorry, Anna?
So in this case, like the first, because he understands suffering as it comes to be, or
yeah, and yes. One understands. So you don't. So remember, this is a idam dukkhan. This is suffering. One understands as it has come to be. This is suffering, or in accordance with condition. Essentially, it means. I mean, literally, it means in accordance with dependent origination. So this is always the.
So he understands suffering in accordance with conditions.
Something like that. Yeah.
So he understands suffering at this moment as it's.
As it has come to be. As it has come to be.
As it is here and now, according to whatever it was that created.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. So it's, and it's the knowledge. So it's not just the knowledge. Oh, this hurts, right? Yeah. That's the point. That's the point. It's not just saying, oh, ow. It's saying, I understand this, I understand the context of it, I understand where this has come from. Right? So this is always the knowledge of the stream entry. Right? So when you see the Four Noble Truths expressed like this, it means stream entry. When I say always, I mean always until someone finds an example where it's not. Okay? Yeah. Usually it is. I don't know of any cases where it's not. And then the next one is the standard destruction, the standard description of the arahantship. So, and then that's the same formula of the Four Noble Truths, but it is time expressed in terms of asava, of defilements, rather than dukkha. So the stream enterer sees dukkha, sees suffering and the ending of suffering and so on. but they don't yet fully understand and fully see and fully let go of all the defilements. Okay, so in particular, the defilements mentioned here, this being the earlier list of defilements, kamasava, sensuality, bhavasava, existence or rebirth, and avijasava is delusion. So it refers to the full defilements as abandoned by the arahant.
So the dukkha is really referring to the grosser dukkha, not more subtle, unsatisfactory, very quiet.
No, he sees those things, but he's just not able to it doesn't end or make an end of them all yet. So the stream mantra does see the subtlety of dukkha, he understands dependent origination and so on. Yeah, but hasn't completely ended it.
Better we probably want to have stream before he sees like the most blissful state of suffering, because if he would, he'd be hard. He sees the hell of suffering.
No, he does see sub-sankhara dukkha. So, you know, you couldn't say that he fully understands them, but he does understand them.
Yeah.
He or she? Sorry? Well, the fetters is just a different term. Okay, so fetters is just a synonym for asava, but it's just a different word. There's actually many terms for defilements in the suttas. And asava being one, fetters, sanyojana being another, and many others. It's the same. It's just a different word for the same thing. Yeah. I agree. I think it's incongruous there. It's not only that it just tends to appear in texts that look later. It just appears incongruous because it appears to the stream mantra, whereas the others apply to the arahant. When Kamasava would be the non-returner, but the other ones obviously the arahant. So. So the Four Noble Truths, seeing the Four Noble Truths, ending the Four Noble Truths, well, that obviously could be another few months of discussion on that. But obviously it's something that does come up. But just since we are taking the chance to have a look at one of the reasons, incidentally, why I'm referring to the Sudhimagga here, as well as just because it gives sometimes interesting examples and stuff, but also when we were doing the history class, I wanted to look at the Visuddhimagga a bit, and we didn't get the chance, so I'm just taking the chance to sort of put in a bit here, just so that you get familiar with the text a little bit and have some idea of what it contains and how it goes about things and what it's useful for and these kinds of things. So let's just have a quick look at what the Visuddhimagga says about the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering has the characteristic of afflicting. Its function is to burn. It's manifested as occurrence or rebirth. The truth of... Okay, so this is this kind of method that the commentaries use to analyse ideas, and so they divide them into characteristics, manifestation, and function. the truth of origin has the characteristic of producing, its function is to prevent interruption. Okay? It is manifested as impediment. The truth of cessation has a characteristic of peace. Its function is not to die. Interesting. Cessation has the function of not dying. It is manifested as the signless. The truth of the path has the characteristic of an outlet. Its function is to abandon defilements. It's manifested as emergence. Okay, so the meaning of truth. It goes on to say, tracing the meaning of the truth, the noble truth. It is that which, for those who examine it with the eye of understanding, is not misleading like an illusion, deceptive like a mirage, or undiscoverable like the self of the sectarians, but is rather the domain of noble knowledge as the real, unmisleading, actual state with its aspects of affliction, production, quiet, and outlet. It is this real, unmisleading actualness that should be understood as the meaning of truth, just as heat is a characteristic of fire, and so on. And then it gives some verses. There is no pain, but is affliction, and naught that is not pain afflicts. This certainty that it afflicts is what is reckoned here as truth. There is no other source of pain than craving, nor aught that source provides that pain. This certainty in causing pain is why it's called considered truth. There is no peace except Nibbana. Nibbana cannot be but peace. This certainty that it is peace is what is reckoned here as truth. No outlet other than the path, nor fails the path to be the outlet. Its status as the very outlet has made it recognized as a truth. This real infallibility, which is their true essential core, is what the wise declare to be truth's meaning common to all four. Okay, so, why are there neither less nor more than four noble truths? Okay? Which is a kind of interesting question. Why are there four of them? Not why aren't there five noble truths? Sorry? Because of the, well, there's three seasons in ancient India. So there's two possible answers, basically two possible answers. One is that there's four of them, because, well, why are there, how many cars on the driveway there? Three cars there, because you walk along and you see there's three cars, right? And you count them. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that it's a convention, and that actually the truth can be expressed in many different ways. And that's a conventional way of teaching, which has its own teaching purpose, or perhaps its own cultural context, or something like that. So there's two possible answers to that. But the Visuddhimagga says there is four because no other exists, and because none can be eliminated. Okay. Okay, furthermore, when announcing occurrence, that is the process of existence, the Blessed One announced it with a cause, and he pronounced non-occurrence as having a means thereto. So they are stated as four at the most, as occurrence and non-occurrence and the cause of each. Okay, so that's giving a logical thing. You've got occurrence of suffering, the non-occurrence of suffering, and then you've got the two causes of both of those things. The cause of suffering is the second noble truth, the cause of the non-suffering is the fourth noble truth. So it's giving a kind of a logical analysis. You've eliminated logical possibilities there. Likewise, they say that it's four, but since they have to be respectively fully understood, abandoned, realized, and developed, not that convincing. Also, since they are the basis for craving, the cessation of craving, and the means of the cessation of craving, neither particularly convincing. So it's mainly emphasizing this idea that the four kind of are really there. There's actually four, which just for myself, I prefer to see them as more conventional, that the Buddha actually described things in many different ways in different contexts, sometimes only two. Sometimes he'd say just suffering and the ending of suffering. And then in other ways he would say, you know, you have to investigate the origin, disappearance, the gratification, the danger and the escape. So there would be like a fivefold analysis. Or in other kinds it would be like dependent origination, where you have a 12-fold analysis and so on. So the particular perspective, to me, the particular perspective depends on how you want to look at things, rather than being something which objectively exists there in the world.
Well, there was really no written in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
I know that it was compiled, but would it go through all of the original stuff that we got?
Yeah, the original commentaries were originally brought from India, but mostly they're Sri Lankan. And the Visuddhimagga itself is, you know, you'll frequently find examples of monks in Sri Lanka, and much less frequently do you find examples of monks in India.
I think they're just very logical. They love logic, didn't they?
They did, yeah. Yeah, no doubt about that. Okay. Okay, so as to order, this too is only the order of teaching. In other words, it's saying that this is just conventional. The truth of suffering is first because it's easy to understand because of its grossness and it's common to all living things. The truth of origin is given next to show its cause. That's the truth of cessation, to make it known with the cessation of the cause, there's the cessation of the fruit. And the truth of the path comes last to show the means to achieve that. Or alternatively, the truth of suffering was taught first to instill a sense of urgency into living beings caught up in enjoyment of the pleasure of rebirth. And next to that, the truth of origin, and so on. So, okay. Then it goes on to give a definition of each of the terms, independent origination, start with the truth of suffering and birth, and it gives a technical analysis in terms of the Abhidhamma understanding of birth and so on. Now it goes on to talk about suffering, and it says why is birth suffering, and it says, well, there's the many kinds of suffering, and then gives the three important kinds of suffering which is a very important category. Dukkha, dukkha, and viparinama dukkha. And sankhara dukkha. So this is a group of three kinds of dukkha, which you find mentioned in the suttas, and which became a very important analysis of dukkha in the later traditions. For example, if you hear Dalai Lama talking about dukkha, then he'll usually use this particular categorization as very fundamental, so which suggests probably was very fundamental in the Abhidhamma Kosha. So, according to the description of these things here, in the Visuddhimagga, dukkha dukkha equals bodily and mental painful feeling. Okay? So this is dukkha dukkha, sometimes translated as intrinsic suffering, okay? So it's just suffering, right? Because suffering is just pain. Exactly. Bog ordinary, hurty suffering. Exactly. Yeah. Any kind of problem. See? Example one, right? we don't need to wander out into the park with our charioteers to see old people, sick people and dead people. So, good, so there we go, the dukkha. Bodily and mental pleasant feeling. Are we parinama dukkha? Alright. Suffering of change, viparinama. Right. So viparinama we translate as change, but actually it's actually closer to the English word degeneration. You know, viparinama means something like to degenerate or to fall apart or something like that. It's always used in the case of someone like, you know, who's very young and so on, but then change and alteration will come to them, viparinama, which means basically that they're going to die. And so viparinama is a bit stronger than change, but we usually translate it as the suffering of change. Viparinama dukkha, bodily and mental pleasant feelings. Okay, so even though they're pleasant when you have them, then they are suffering in their change.
So they're suffering when you don't have them. Because you have them, you suffer bigger than they got. Is that what you mean? Or they are
of themselves suffering? Well, that's a very good point, yes. Now, if you have a look at what this means and what it doesn't mean. Let's say if you have ice cream, and then you have one ice cream and you experience bodily pleasant feelings, right? Maybe you experience mental pleasant feelings because you're also thinking, wow, there's another ice cream in the pack and maybe I can have another one of them, right? So you can have mental pleasant feelings as well. And so you experience this hook, and then you keep on eating them, and then later on you experience bodily and mental painful feelings because you get sick from eating all the ice cream and then you feel remorseful and guilty because you were so stupid as to eat it all, right? So then you experience dukkha. Yeah? Now that is not viparinama dukkha. Yeah? Because what you're actually experiencing then is dukkha, right? The pleasant feelings actually change into painful feelings. So viparinama dukkha is the suffering that you experience from change, if you think of a change without any painful feeling. Yeah? So to give one example of that, say somebody in jhana, who's say in third jhana, experiencing only bliss, purified bliss and happiness, and then they go to second jhana, yeah, where they're also experiencing only purified bliss, but not quite as good as the third jhana. Yeah? That is viparinama dukkha. Okay, it's the suffering of change.
So does it occur at the moment of change, or does it occur as I'm eating ice cream and I reflect how it's going to end? So I'm experiencing pleasant feelings, but my reflection brings
the... Your reflection bringing the dukkha is again dukkha. So if you get depressed by the fact that it's going to end, then the depression that arises there is the dukkha. Viparinama dukkha is the fact that it's broken already. Ajahn Chah gave the simile, you know, what is anicca? So he picked up a cup and said it's broken already. Yeah. So that's the viparinama dukkha, is that it's in the nature of things to change.
So it doesn't occur in the moment of change, it's already
I guess you'd say it's inherent in the process, but it becomes apparent at the moment of change. Yeah. You know, No, that's under here. Yeah?
In this, the inference from this that, that everything is suffering.
Well, obviously.
I know that.
This is basically the Wowsers dukkha. You know, it's like, ooh, you're going to pay for it. It's Glaswegian dukkha, like Billy Connolly said, in Glasgow, when they have a bright sunny day, they look up at the sky and say, oh, we're going to pay for this. That's dukkha dukkha, yeah. Mm. Yeah. But the
it's a beautiful day today.
Becoming a little bit less beautiful is vikarinama dukkha.
But even if it didn't change, if it remained beautiful all day.
Forever?
I don't know.
Then it wouldn't be dukkha.
But the time that it's not. But the thing is, I suppose the thing is that everything, it's inherent everything that is always changing.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So because
of
our nature, no matter
how pleasant
it is, it's still dukkha. Yeah. I think it's the other way
around. Sorry?
I think it's the other way around.
What? Success forever is dukkha. Well, it depends what it is, yeah.
Isn't it beautiful then?
Yeah.
Can you just give another example that can clearly indicate the difference between these two? Because from my understanding, dukkha probably occurs when one goes sick or gets hurt or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then vipassanama is something that changes from pleasant to unpleasant, brings about. Is that right?
No, if something changes from pleasant to unpleasant, then it's dukkha dukkha. Yeah, so the unpleasant feeling is dukkha dukkha. Yeah. Vikarinama dukkha happens when anything pleasant changes. Yeah, or even neutral. So that's why I gave the example. It's a change from a pleasant feeling to a slightly less pleasant feeling. Yeah, that's vipariṇāma dukkha. There's no actual pain there because the pain comes under dukkha dukkha. So even just a more simple example, if you're just drinking a cup of coffee in the morning, yeah, the first sip you have is so delightful. Second sip you have is slightly less delightful. That's vipariṇāma dukkha.
That's not change. That's
No, but the pleasure is changed. Well, that's what it is. That's
but
what the dukkha is.
To me, that means that it's the dukkha of the things that even if they don't change, your feeling of them do change. Yes.
But the dukkha itself is the feeling.
Yes, but it's the things that don't necessarily change. Like I said, if you live in a country where 365 days a year is pleasant, you get depressed by it, I promise you. I know. Because sometimes you need the change just to be able to...
I know, but that... I understand that point, but it's not quite the point of what this means. What this means is the change of the feeling. Whether the external changes or doesn't change doesn't matter. But the point of here is that the feelings have changed.
What do you think? But the word is pleasant, and it's yeah. Not changing to the unpleasant.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
But what if it changes? Like your coffee, you have a good
yeah.
Sip. Then
it's the
next
sip,
and
it's even
better.
I don't know if that's possible. Yeah, that can, but this is more talking about the falling away of pleasant feeling. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
So, one thing, has this anything to do with the knowledge that becoming known? Am I to say that having dealt with pleasant feeling, we know that this pleasant feeling is not going to last? And that changes will definitely take place. So does that come under this category? The knowledge that this pleasant feeling will not, this bodily feeling.
Yeah. even that's making it too complicated. This doesn't just apply to people who are practicing Dhamma and who are reflecting about the nature of suffering. This applies to everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
So whatever pleasant feeling that you're having will become less pleasant. That's what viparinama dukkha is.
I mean, we do know that anything
pleasant
will not last long, right? Due to changes of sunshine.
Yeah. Okay, let me just give the example again. Dukkha dukkha is where you actually experience something unpleasant. Viparinama dukkha is where you experience something pleasant, but then experience something slightly less pleasant. It's got nothing to do with your reflection about those experiences. This is not talking about a practice of understanding them. We're just looking at what the thing is. Okay? So you keep on bringing these examples in, oh, if you reflect on that dukkha, you understand that. That's not what this is talking about, okay? This is simply describing what the dukkha is, not describing about a person who's reflecting on the dukkha. So forget about reflecting on it. Reflect about a person who's practicing. Forget about anybody who's ever heard about Buddhism or the Noble Path or meditation. What actually is experienced like? Well, some experience is objectively painful. You feel it and it hurts. Other experience you experience, it feels pleasant, but then after a while feels less pleasant. That is viparinama dukkha.
Yeah?
No, you go in and it's horrible and freezing.
No,
and then you Of course, they're all related. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but this is like extending it. Yeah. Anyway, let's just go on. Let's have a look at Sankhara Dukkha. This might clarify things. And this is the suffering of Sankharas, which perhaps activities or conditions or what other word can we use for Sankharas? Aggregates, yeah, not quite literal. Sankhara, dukkha, activities, conditions. Not just mental. Energies.
Transgression.
Sorry?
Transgression.
No, it doesn't mean transgression. Activities.
Movement.
Yeah. In a very general sense.
Change.
Closely related to the idea of change, but change is more here. They're very closely connected. But anyway, so see what the Visuddhimagga has. Okay. Anyway, the basic idea here is that sankhara means conditions. It means everything except for nibbana. Okay? So the easiest way of understanding sankhara dukkha is that nothing is as peaceful as nibbana. So sankhara dukkha is simply the fact that nothing else is as peaceful as nibbana. And so that includes even the very highest meditation attainments or anything like that is all included under sankhara dukkha. Okay? Its inherent nature is it's conditioned, and because it's conditioned, there's something unstable about it. There's something active about it. And because of that, it's never completely peaceful and completely still. Okay? So So Anyway, that's enough on that. So again, it's to come back. It's talking now about it's on suffering as birth as suffering, and so it then gives a rather vivid description of birth as suffering. Birth as suffering is rooted in the descent into the womb. When this being is born in the mother's womb, he is not born inside a blue or red or white lotus, etc., but on the contrary, like a worm in rotting fish, rotting dough, cesspools, etc., he is born in the belly, in a position that is below the receptacle for undigested food and above the receptacle for digested food, between the belly lining and the backbone, which is very cramped, completely dark, pervaded by very fetid airs, redolent of various smells of ordure, and exceptionally loathsome. And on being reborn there for 10 months, he undergoes excessive suffering, being cooked like a pudding in a bag by the heat produced in the mother's womb, and steamed like a dumpling of dough. When the mother suddenly moves or sits around, then the extreme suffering he undergoes by being dragged back and forth and jolted up and down like a kid fallen into the hands of a drunkard, or like a snake young falling into the hands of a snake charmer, and also the searing pain that he undergoes as though he had reappeared in the cold hells when his mother drinks cold water, and as though deluged by a rain of embers when she swallows hot rice gruel, and so on, and as though undergoing the torture of the lye pickling, the acid pickle, when she swallows anything salt or acidic. This is the suffering rooted in gestation.
Whether they're experiencing pleasure or anyone know anything about them?
Yeah,
they're happy.
Yeah, because they dream and they smile.
There you go.
They float about. And, you know.
Dancing.
Like the humans have lots of strength, and they can tune into the vibrate mother's voice and various outside sort of stimuli. But I think if the Buddhist notion is true, then whatever temperament they have to do with whatever they want themselves.
Yeah.
So babies were angry and women were angry, and so if it is true, then the consciousness that they're born with is already there. Yeah. And sort of being next to excrement and all this time, of course that's true. But, you know, when you're sleeping in the studio, 1, 2, 3, 4, you're quite close to excrement. There's a lot of sleeping. But you just, you're totally,
well, you don't have to go and sleep in the studio to be close to excrement. I hate to disappoint you. Most of us are fairly close to it most of the time. Well, we have to. Well, exactly. Yeah. It's only the things in us which we find disgusting things, you know. Outside of us are not nearly so bad. But I mean, it is interesting how whenever it comes to anything which is to do with the revoltingness of the body and everything, then Buddha Gosa is just so eloquent and vivid and descriptive, and he just lets loose. It's great. I have never heard anything about specifically about that. I mean, generally speaking, I think the level of, you know, it's like you're dreaming or in a kind of dream state, so I don't think people are very aware most of the time. I mean, I think you're aware on a subconscious level, but not really. I don't know. Has anyone else heard of anything?
Well, there's this concern that the discourse that you just mentioned about the process of conception in the womb.
There is, but not in kind of detail like this. There's a mention in a few places of a classification of different stages of the growth of the embryo, and actually has quite a lot of names for them.
Not all this disgusting.
No.
How did it deal with the drug addicted to Terry? It was like being back in the womb with your mother,
uh-huh.
And water was going to.
There you go, if you want to test it out.
It's like getting born and it's cold and...
Yeah. Well, exactly. I think for you know, it's usually the coming out, which is the problem for most people, rather than being inside.
I think, of course, something like immediately in the womb, there's always a kind of coin like that. Just like a member of it. It's obviously not very exciting, not very... Not an extra mention of it.
Right. Yeah. It's just a presence. Yeah. So the pain that arises in him when the mother gives birth through him being turned upside down and flung into that most fearful passage from the womb, like an infernal chasm, and lugged out through the extremely narrow mouth of the womb like an elephant through a keyhole, like a denizen of hell being pounded to pulp by colliding rocks. This is the suffering room. Well, exactly, yeah, that's right, yeah. The pain that arises in him after he's born and his body, which is as delicate as a tender wound, is taken in the hands, bathed, washed, rubbed with cloths, etc., and which pain is like being pricked with needle points and gashed with razor blades. And the pain afterwards, so that's the pain of birth. So, aging, suffering, nothing too interesting there. Death is suffering, nothing too interesting with these ones. I'm just saying there's too much to be able to go through everything. Burning in the mind. Lamentation, verbal clamour on the part of one affected by loss of relatives and so on, has crying out at his characteristic. Pain. Those, so grief, dominus, are those who are gripped by grief, tear their hair, weep, thump their breasts, twist and writhe, throw themselves upside down and use the knife, swallow poison, hang themselves with ropes, walk into fires and undergo many kinds of suffering. And then despair. And then the relationship between sorrow, lamentation and despair is described that sorrow is like the cooking of oil in a pot over a slow fire. Lamentation is like the oil bubbling over from the pot when cooking over a quick fire. Despair is like what remains in the pot after it is boiled over and can't boil any more, cooking and cooking the pot until it all dries up. Sounds quite a nice description. Everything with love, separation from the love. Okay, aggregates. Nothing hugely interesting in there. Origin of suffering. Again, nothing hugely interesting. Cessation of suffering. Oh, yeah, here we have the simile of the lions and dogs, which you may have heard me talk about from time to time. So suffering ceases with the cessation of the origin, the targeters behave like lions. When they make suffering cease and when they teach the cessation of suffering, they deal with the cause, not the fruit. But when the sectarians behave like dogs, when they make suffering cease and they teach the cessation of suffering, by teaching devotion to self-mortification, etc., they deal with the fruit, not the cause. Okay, and then the sub-commentary remarks that just as a lion directs his strength against the man who shot the arrow at him, not against the arrow, so the Buddhas deal with the cause but not the fruit. But dogs, when struck with a clod, snarl and bite the clod and do not attack the striker. So the sectarians who want to make suffering cease devote themselves to mutilating the body and to causing cessation of defilements. Right. So discussion. Okay, and then it's talking about the cessation of suffering. So the discussion on Nibbana, which is quite an interesting little discussion here, is Nibbana. So there's a series of questions and answers. Is Nibbana non-existent because it is unapprehendable, like the rabbit's horn? Okay, so this is a classic category that's used in Indian logic what sense does something not exist? So the rabbit's horn is always given as an example of something that doesn't exist. Does Nibbana not exist in the same sense that a rabbit's horn does not exist? And it says, no, that's not the case because it can be apprehended by the right means, by the right practice, by the noble ones and so on. Again, it should not be said that Nibbana does not exist because then the path would be futile. So then the questioner then responds, but the futility of the way does not follow because what is reached is absence, that is the absence of the five aggregates when the defilements are cut off. And the answer, that is not so, because although there is the absence of past and future aggregates, there is nevertheless no reaching of Nibbana simply because of that. And then the questioner again, is it the absence of the present aggregates as well, Nibbana? That is not so, because their absence is an impossibility, because if they are absent, their non-presence follows. Besides, if Nibbana were absence of presence aggregate too, that would entail the fault of excluding the arising of the Nibbana element with the result of past clinging left at the past moment which has present aggregates as its support. So the question here is Nibbana actually something which exists, or is it merely the absence of suffering? Okay, so is it just the non-existence of the khandhas, of defilements, of suffering, or is it an actual thing in some sense that exists? And the orthodox point of view here that's being argued is that it actually exists. And one of the reasons it says is that because the Buddha made the distinction in the canon between the Nibbana experience in this life as the happiness of the arahant or the state of the arahant in this life and also the nirvana that's really reached at the end of life, the complete ending of all the khandhas. And so it's making the point that if nirvana meant the non-existence of all aggregates, then that distinction would be meaningless. So then what about, then the questioner goes on, pressing his point, well, what about if we say that it's the absence of the defilements that is nirvana? Remembering that that's how nirvana was defined repeatedly in the suttas, yeah? Ending of greed, hatred and delusion is nirvana. Yeah? The Buddha said this again and again and again. But the orthodox position says no, that's not so, because it would then follow that the noble path was meaningless. For if that were so, then since defilements can be non-existent also before the moment of the noble path, it follows that the noble path would be meaningless. So this is a kind of curious little statement there, but presumably what he's saying is that the defilements can be non-existent in the sense of not actually having arisen. So in the mind at any one time, defilements may be present or absent, but the mere fact that one happens to not be angry at that particular moment doesn't mean that one's attained nirvana. Okay? So this is the argument that's going on in nirvana. But then his questioner again says, but doesn't nirvana mean the ending, the kaya, because of the passage saying this is the ending of greed, hatred and delusion is nirvana from the suttas? That is not so, because it would follow that arahantship also was mere kaya, mere destruction. So that's also described in the same way. That which is the ending of greed, hatred and delusion is arahantship. Okay, so that's quite a neat little argument. When the Buddha said that greed, hatred and nirvana is the ending of greed, hatred and delusion, he also said that arahantship is the ending of greed, hatred and delusion. But an arahant is obviously a person. He carries around a body, they speak, they have thoughts and emotions and things. Yeah? It's not just the ending of those defilements. And so he's arguing by inference, therefore, that nirvana is also not just the ending of defilements. So what is more, the fallacy then follows that nirvana would be temporary, for if it was so, it would follow that nirvana would have the characteristic of being formed and attainable regardless of right effort, and precisely because of its having formed characteristics, it would be included in the forms, the sankhata, sankhara, and etc. So in other words, it's again this idea that defilements can be temporarily absent from the mind, but that's not the realization of nirvana.
So,
Yeah, in the full sense, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Look, I would agree. I would agree completely, yeah. But according to the Abhidhamma, we should remember that these are Abhidhammists who are discussing here. According to the Abhidhamma, you know, you can do sort of greed, hatred, delusion, and non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, a kind of temporary states which the mind can possess at any time. Yeah. But I would certainly agree with you in terms of the way delusion is used in the suttas, it's definitely true. Okay, is there no fallacy then, goes the questioner on to ask, if nirvana is that kind of destruction subsequent to which there is no more re-arising? Okay, so we're not saying that nirvana is just any kind of ending, any kind of kaya, but it's a specific kind of kaya which is not followed by any more arising. Seems a little bit tautologous, but the answer goes, that is not so, because there is no such kind of destruction, of ending. Yeah, it's a somewhat curious statement. Obviously, I would have thought that the ending of defilements at arahantship is precisely that kind of ending, but anyway. Even if there were, the aforesaid fallacies would not be avoided, also because it would follow that the noble path was nirvana, for the noble path causes the destruction of defilements, and that's why it's called destruction, or kaya. And subsequent to that, there's no more occurrence of the defects, but it's because the kind of ending called cessation, consisting in non-arising, that is nirvana, serves figuratively speaking as decisive support for the path that nirvana is called ending as a metaphor for it. Okay, so it's saying here that the word kaya is a metaphor for nirvana. So why then, the questioner says, isn't it stated directly? Okay, so why is the Buddha always using these metaphors? Why doesn't he just call it what it is? And the answer, because of its extreme subtlety, and its extreme subtlety is established because it inclined the Blessed One to not teach the Dhamma, and because the Arian's eye is needed to see it. And it is uncreated because it has no first beginning. Questioner then goes on, since it is, when the path is, then it is not uncreated. In other words, is it the case that Nibbana is actually produced by the path? Yeah, so it's created by the path. That is not so, because it is not arousable by the path. It is only reachable, not arousable by the path. That's why it's uncreated. And it's because it's uncreated that it is free from aging and death. And it is because of the absence of its creation and its aging and death, it is permanent. Okay, so Nibbana is Nietzsche, is permanent. Then it follows that Nibbana too has the kind of permanence claimed of the atom and so on. The atom, the paramanu. That is not so, because of the absence of any cause that brings about its arising. So the atom by this stage of Indian philosophy was not dissimilar to the way that we use the word atom in the West in modern times, or at least the underlying sort of popular idea of the atom as being an indivisible sort of unit of matter. Of course, that's not what atom is understood as in physics these days, but that's the sort of the basic underlying idea of an atom. And a paramanu is the term, but it's a similar kind of idea. And so some theorists had the opinion that the atoms themselves were permanent, that they weren't just destroyed, and this is the idea that's being referred to here, which is still discussed in modern physics. There are different views, for example, whether a proton is permanent or impermanent. There are some people who believe that a proton actually lasts forever. Yeah, well, presumably you can break them up in a... I'm not quite sure, but yeah, I know that was the idea, and I read this article on it some years ago, and they said that the Japanese wanted to test it. So to test it, they got this big dam, like a big tank, a huge tank full of heavy water, with all this, and bunged it in the middle of a mountain, and did this experiment, and they worked out statistically that they had so many billions and billions of protons there, that according to the most likely theory, that statistically after like a period of 20 years or 10 years or whatever, that one of those protons would decay, and they could measure that. Yeah? So they put it inside the mountain to stop cosmic rays and things like that from getting there. So this was the idea, that they could sit and watch that for like 10 years or something and then see if any protons would decay. But then after they'd already built that and they'd done the experiment for a few years, then they redid the math and they figured out that actually they'd have to be watching for like 1,000 years or something like that instead of for 10 years. So it kind of blew that experiment out of the water anyway. So that was a bit of a problem. So anyway, this is this idea. But of course, the Nibbana is not permanent in the same way, because those things are produced. Nibbana is not, because Nibbana has permanence. Okay. Because Nibbana is permanent, then is that why the atom, etc., is permanent as well? And the response is, that's not the case, that's not a logical, doesn't logically follow that Nibbana, the permanence of Nibbana means the permanence of anything else. Then are they permanent? Are atoms and so on permanent because of the absence of their arising, as Nibbana is? The answer, that is not so. Because the atom and so on have not been established as fact. The aforesaid logical reasoning proves only that this, that Nibbana is permanent because it's uncreated, and it is immaterial because it transcends the nature of matter. Okay? So that is a description on the nature of, a discussion on the nature of Nibbana. But it's just interesting because it shows how these questions were not at all necessarily clear or agreed on in the community. And so this is a kind of a record of these things. And of course, this is still a very active debate in Buddhism today, is whether Nibbana literally just means ending, or whether it actually exists in some sense. So the Theravadan point of view generally, the orthodox Theravadan point of view, is that Nibbana actually exists. It actually has a svabhava. It is an existent state of some form, but that state is so subtle that it can't be described or qualified in any further way other than simply to say that it exists and it's unconditioned. Okay, other schools tended to then develop that further to these ideas of Nibbana as the original mind or something like that, where you're getting a more descriptive notion of Nibbana. And obviously some kinds of Buddhists had the idea that Nibbana actually was mere cessation, kayamata, pure cessation, just the ending of things.
Right.
Well, he said, I teach the annihilation of greed, hatred and delusion, but that, perhaps that's not what you meant. So Nyan Moli has a long and interesting note here where he analyses the argument and he notes that the sub-commentary then takes up this discussion and further develops it. I won't go through the sub-commentaries. Paramattha Manjusa, the discussion there. Then he says that there are later arguments in the Abhidhamma Avatara, another later book, but then later books than that appear to have shelved the problem. So it's something which was a kind of, there's a number of texts discussing it around that period of the Visuddhimagga and a bit later, but then by the time you get to 10th, 11th, 12th century, the discussion appears to have been put to one side without necessarily having been solved. And he makes a very interesting note, which is that in the whole of this discussion, no mention is made of the abandoning of the inherent tendencies, the anusaya, in the attainment of Nibbana. So all this discussion about, well, you know, you cannot have greed, hatred and delusion in your mind and so on, it doesn't take into account this notion of anusaya, which are supposedly still present there, according to the suttas. So just to continue with the description of the Noble Truths in the Visuddhimagga, it then goes on the Noble Eightfold Path, which I won't discuss there. So that's probably enough for now for that discussion of the Noble Truth then. So anyway, this is just the part of the very long discussion in the Visuddhimagga on the suffering. So we haven't finished the Asavakaya Jnana yet. So it's getting a little bit late, so maybe we should leave the rest of that for next week.